Gary Pervier sat out on his weedy front lawn at the bottom of Seven Oaks Hill on Town Road No. 3 about a week after Vic and Roger's depressing luncheon meeting at the Yellow Sub, drinking a screwdriver that was 25% bird's-eye frozen orange juice and 75% pop-off vodka. He sat in the shade of an elm that was in the last stages of rampant Dutch elm disease, his bottom resting against the frayed straps of a Sears Roebuck mail-order lawn chair that was in the last stages of useful service. He was drinking Popoff because Popoff was cheap. Gary had purchased a large supply of it in New Hampshire, where booze was cheaper, on his last liquor run. Popoff was cheap in Maine, but it was dirt cheap in New Hampshire, a state which took its stand for the finer things in life: a fat state lottery, cheap booze, cheap cigarettes, and tourist attractions like Santa's Village and Six Gun City. New Hampshire was a great old place. The lawn chair had slowly settled into his run-to-riot lawn, digging deep divots. The house behind the lawn had also run to riot. It was a gray, paint-peeling, roof-sagging shambles. Shutters hung. The chimney hooked at the sky like a drunk trying to get up from a tumble. Shingles blown off in the previous winter's last big storm still hung limply from some of the branches of the dying elm. "It ain't the Taj Mahal," Gary sometimes said, "but who gives a shit?" Gary was, on this swelteringly hot late June day, as drunk as a coot. This was not an uncommon state of affairs with him. He did not know Roger Breakstone from shit. He did not know Vic Trenton from shit. He didn't know Donna Trenton from shit, and if he had known her, he wouldn't have given a shit if the visiting team was throwing line drives into her catcher's mitt. He did know the Cambers and their dog Cujo. The family lived up the hill at the end of Town Road No. 3. He and Joe Camber did a good deal of drinking together, and in a rather foggy fashion, Gary realized that Joe Camber was already a goodly way down the road to alcoholism. It was a road Gary himself had toured extensively. "Just a good-for-nothing drunk, and I don't give a shit," Gary told the birds and the shingles in the diseased elm. He tipped his glass. He farted. He swatted a bug. Sunlight and shadow dappled his face. Behind the house, a number of disemboweled cars had almost disappeared in the tall weeds. The ivy which grew on the west side of his house had gone absolutely apeshit, almost covering it. One window peeked out, barely, and on sunny days it glittered like a dirty diamond. 2 years ago, in a drunken frenzy, Gary had uprooted a bureau from one of the upstairs rooms and had thrown it out a window. He could not remember why now. He had reglazed the window himself because it had let in one crotch of a draft come winter, but the bureau rested exactly where it had fallen. One drawer was popped out like a tongue. In 1944, when Gary Pervier had been 20, he had single-handedly taken a German pillbox in France, and following that exploit had led the remains of his squad 10 miles farther before collapsing with the 6 bullet wounds he had suffered in his charge of the machine gun emplacement. For this, he had been awarded one of his grateful country's highest honors, the Distinguished Service Cross. In 1968, he had gotten Buddy Torgerson down in Castle Falls to turn the medal into an ashtray. Buddy had been shocked. Gary told Buddy he would have gotten him to make it into a toilet bowl so he could shit in it, but it wasn't big enough. Buddy spread the story, and maybe that had been Gary's intention. Or maybe it hadn't. Either way, it had driven the local hippies crazy with admiration. In the summer of 68, most of these hippies were on vacation in the Lakes region with their wealthy parents before returning to their colleges in September, where they were apparently studying up on protest, pot, and pussy. After Gary had his DSC turned into an ashtray by Buddy Torgerson, who did custom welding in his spare time and who worked days down to the Castle Falls Esso, they were all Exxon stations now, and Gary Pervier didn't give a shit. A version of the story found its way into the Castle Rock Call. The story was written by a local yokel reporter who construed the act as an anti-war gesture. That was when the hippies started to show up at Gary's place on Town Road Number 3. Most of them wanted to tell Gary he was far out. Some of them wanted to tell him he was some kind of heavy. A few wanted to tell him he was too fucking much. Gary showed them all the same thing, which was his Winchester 30-06. He told them to get off his property. As far as he was concerned, they were all a bunch of long-haired, muff-diving, crab-crawling, asshole pinko fucksticks. He told them he didn't give a shit if he blew their guts from Castle Rock to Freiburg. After a while, they stopped coming, and that was the end of the DSC affair. One of those German bullets had taken Gary Pervier's right testicle off. A medic had found most of it splattered across the seat of his GI issue underwear. Most of the other one survived, and sometimes he could still get a pretty respectable bone on. Not, he had frequently told Joe Camber, that he gave much of a shit one way or the other. His grateful country had given him the Distinguished Service Cross. A grateful hospital staff in Paris had discharged him in February 1945 with an 80% disability pension and a gold-plated monkey on his back. A grateful hometown gave him a parade on the 4th of July 1945. By then, he was 21 instead of 20, able to vote, his hair graying around the temples. And he felt all of 700, thank you very much. The grateful town selectmen had remanded the property taxes on the Pervier place in perpetuity. That was good, because he would have lost it 20 years ago otherwise. He had replaced the morphine he could no longer obtain with high-tension booze, and had then proceeded to get about his life's work, which was killing himself as slowly and as pleasantly as he could. Now, in 1980, he was 56 years old, totally gray, and meaner than a bull with a jackhandle up its ass. About the only three living creatures he could stand were Joe Camber, his boy Brett, and Brett's big St. Bernard, Cujo. He tilted back in the decaying lawn chair, almost went over on his back, and used up some more of his screwdriver. The screwdriver was in a glass he had gotten free from a McDonald's restaurant. There was some sort of purple animal on the glass, something called a grimace. Gary ate a lot of his meals at the Castle Rock McDonald's, where you could still get a cheap hamburger. Hamburgers were good, but as for the grimace and Mayor McCheese and Monsieur Ronald fucking McDonald, Gary Pervier didn't give a shit for any of them. A broad, tawny shape was moving through the high grass to his left, and a moment later, Cujo, on one of his rambles, emerged into Gary's tattered front yard. He saw Gary and barked once, politely. Then he came over, wagging his tail.
"Cujo, you old son of a whore," Gary said.
He put his screwdriver down and began digging methodically through his pockets for dog biscuits. He always kept a few on hand for Cujo, who was one of your old-fashioned, dyed-in-the-wool good dogs. He found a couple in his shirt pocket and held them up.
"Sit, boy. Sit up."
No matter how low or how mean he was feeling, the sight of that 200-pound dog sitting up like a rabbit never failed to tickle him. Cujo sat up, and Gary saw a short but ugly-looking scratch healing on the dog's muzzle. Gary tossed him the biscuits, which were shaped like bones, and Cujo snapped them effortlessly out of the air. He dropped one between his forepaws and began to gnaw the other one.
"Good dog," Gary said, reaching out to pat Cujo's head. "Good."
Cujo began to growl, deep in his throat. It was a rumbling, almost reflective sound. He looked up at Gary, and there was something cold and speculative in the dog's eyes that gave Gary a chill. He took his hand back to himself quickly. A dog as big as Cujo was nothing to get screwing around with, not unless you wanted to spend the rest of your life wiping your ass with a hook.
"What's got into you, boy?" Gary asked. He had never heard Cujo growl, not in all the years the Cambers had had him. To tell the truth, he wouldn't have believed old Cujo had a growl in him. Cujo wagged his tail a little bit and came over to Gary to be patted, as if ashamed of his momentary lapse.
"Hey, that's more like it," Gary said, ruffling the big dog's fur.
It had been one scorcher of a week, and more coming, according to George Mira, who had heard it from Aunt Evie Chalmers. He supposed that was it. Dogs felt the heat even more than people did, and he guessed there was no rule against a mutt getting testy once in a while. But it sure had been funny hearing Cujo growl like that. If Joe Camber had told him, Gary wouldn't have believed it.
"Go get your other biscuit," Gary said and pointed.
Cujo turned around, went to the biscuit, picked it up, mouthed it, a long string of saliva depending from his mouth, and then dropped it. He looked at Gary apologetically.
"You turning down chow?" Gary said unbelievingly. "You?"
Cujo picked up the dog biscuit again and ate it.
"That's better," Gary said. "A little heat ain't gonna kill ya. Ain't gonna kill me either, but it bitches the shit out of my hemorrhoids. Well, I don't give a shit if they get as big as fucking golf balls, you know it?"
He swatted a mosquito. Cujo lay down beside Gary's chair as Gary picked up his screwdriver again. It was almost time to go in and freshen it up, as the country club cunt said.
"Freshen up my ass," Gary said.
He gestured at the roof of his house, and a sticky mixture of orange juice and vodka trickled down his sunburned, scrawny arm.
"Look at that chimbley, Cujo guy. Falling right the fuck down. And you know what? I don't give a shit. The whole place could fall flat, and I wouldn't fat sideways to a dime, you know that?"
Cujo thumped his tail a little. He didn't know what this man was saying, but the rhythms were familiar and the patterns were soothing. These polemics had gone on a dozen times a week since, well, as far as Cujo was concerned, since forever. Cujo liked this man, who always had food. Just lately, Cujo didn't seem to want food. But if the man wanted him to eat, he would. Then he could lie here as he was now and listen to the soothing talk. All in all, Cujo didn't feel very well. He hadn't growled at the man because he was hot, but simply because he didn't feel good. For a moment there, just a moment, he had felt like biting the man.
"Got your nose in the brambles, looks like," Gary said. "What was you after? Woodchuck? Rabbit?"
Cujo thumped his tail a little. Crickets sang in the rampant bushes. Behind the house, honeysuckle grew in a wild drift, calling the somnolent bees of a summer afternoon. Everything in Cujo's life should have been right, but somehow it wasn't. He just didn't feel good at all.
"I don't even give a shit if all that Georgia redneck's teeth fall out, and all of Ray Gunn's teeth, too," Gary said, and stood up unsteadily.
The lawn chair fell over and collapsed itself. If you had guessed that Gary Pervier didn't give a shit, you would have been right.
"Excuse me, boy."
He went inside and built himself another screwdriver. The kitchen was a buzzing, fly-blown horror of split-open green garbage bags, empty cans, and empty liquor bottles. When Gary came back out again, fresh drink in hand, Cujo had left.
On the last day of June, Donna Trenton came back from downtown Castle Rock. The locals called it Down Street, but at least she hadn't picked up that particular mainism yet, where she had dropped Tad off at his afternoon day camp and picked up a few groceries at the Agway Market. She was hot and tired, and the sight of Steve Kemp's battered Ford Econoline van with the gaudy desert murals painted on the sides suddenly turned her furious. Anger had simmered all day. Vic had told her about the impending trip at breakfast, and when she had protested being left alone with Tad for what might be 10 days or 2 weeks or God only knew, he made it clear to her exactly what the stakes were. He had thrown a scare into her, and she didn't like to be frightened. Up until this morning, she had treated the Red Raspberry Zingers affair as a joke, a rather good one at Vic and Roger's expense. She had never dreamed that such an absurd thing could have such serious consequences. Then Tad had been scratchy about going off to the day camp, complaining that a bigger boy had pushed him down last Friday. The bigger boy's name was Stanley Dobson, and Tad was afraid that Stanley Dobson might push him down again today. He had cried and clutched onto her when she got him to the American Legion field where the camp was held, and she'd had to pry his fingers loose from her blouse, finger by finger, making her feel more like a Nazi than a mom. "You will go to day camp, ja? Ja, mein mama." Sometimes Tad seemed so young for his age, so vulnerable. Weren't only children supposed to be precocious and resourceful? His fingers had been chocolatey and had left fingerprints on her blouse. They reminded her of the blood-stained handprints you sometimes saw in cheap detective magazines. To add to the fun, her pinto had started to act funny on the way home from the market, jerking and hitching as if it had an automotive case of hiccups. It had smoothed out after a bit, but what could happen once could happen again. And just to put a little icing on the cake, here was Steve Kemp. "Well, no bullshit," she muttered, grabbed her bag of groceries, and got out, a pretty dark-haired woman of 29, tall, gray-eyed. She somehow managed to look tolerably fresh in spite of the relentless heat, her tad-printed blouse, and academy gray shorts that felt pasted to her hips and fanny. She went up the steps quickly and into the house by the porch door. Steve was sitting in Vic's living room chair. He was drinking one of Vic's beers. He was smoking a cigarette, presumably one of his own. The TV was on, and the agonies of General Hospital played out there in living color. "The princess arrives," Steve said with the lopsided grin she had once found so charming and interestingly dangerous. "I thought you were never going to." "I want you out of here, you son of a bitch," she said tonelessly, and went through into the kitchen. She put the grocery bag down on the counter and started putting things away. She could not remember when she had last been so angry, so furious that her stomach had tied itself in a gripping, groaning knot. One of the endless arguments with her mother, maybe. One of the real horror shows before she had gone away to school. When Steve came up behind her and slipped his tanned arms around her bare midriff, she acted with no thought at all. She brought her elbow back into his lower chest. Her temper was not cooled by the obvious fact that he had anticipated her. He played a lot of tennis, and her elbow felt as if it had struck a stone wall coated with a layer of hard rubber. She turned around and looked into his grinning, bearded face. She stood 5'11" and was an inch taller than Vic when she wore heels, but Steve was nearly 6'5". "Didn't you hear me? I want you out of here." "Now, what for?" he asked. "The little one is off making beaded loincloths, or shooting apples off the head of counselors with his little bow and arrow, or whatever they do. And hubby is busting heavies at the office.
And now is the time for Castle Rock's prettiest housefrau and Castle Rock's resident poet and tennis bum to make all the bells of sexual congress chime in lovely harmony.
I see you parked out in the driveway, Donna said. Why not just tape a big sign to the side of your van? I'm fucking Donna Trenton, or something witty like that.
I've got every reason to park in the driveway, Steve said, still grinning. I've got that dresser in the back, stripped clean. Even as I wish you were yourself, my dear.
You can put it on the porch. I'll take care of it. While you're doing that, I'll write you a check. His smile faded a little. For the first time since she had come in, the surface charm slipped a little, and she could see the real person underneath. It was a person she didn't like at all. A person that dismayed her when she thought of him in connection with herself. She had lied to Vic, gone behind his back in order to go to bed with Steve Kemp. She wished that what she felt now could be something as simple as rediscovering herself, as after a nasty bout of fever, or rediscovering herself as Vic's mate. But when you took the bark off it, the simple fact was that Steve Kemp, publishing poet, itinerant furniture stripper and refinisher, chair caner, fair amateur tennis player, excellent afternoon lover, was a turd.
Be serious, he said.
Yeah, no one could reject handsome, sensitive Stephen Kemp, she said. It's got to be a joke. Only it's not. So what you do, handsome, sensitive Stephen Kemp, is put the dresser on the porch, get your check, and blow.
Don't talk to me like that, Donna.
His hand moved to her breast and squeezed. It hurt. She began to feel a little scared as well as angry. But hadn't she been a little scared all along? Hadn't that been part of the nasty, scuzzy little thrill of it? She slapped his hand away.
Don't you get on my case, Donna.
He wasn't smiling now.
It's too goddamn hot.
Me? On your case? You were here when I came in. Being frightened of him had made her angrier than ever. He wore a heavy black beard that climbed high on his cheekbones, and it occurred to her suddenly that although she had seen his penis close up, had had it in her mouth, she had never really seen what his face looked like.
What you mean, he said, is that you had a little itch, and now it's scratched, so fuck off, right? Who gives a crap about how I feel?
You're breathing on me, she said, and pushed him away to take the milk to the refrigerator. He was not expecting it this time. Her shove caught him off balance, and he actually stumbled back a step. His forehead was suddenly divided by lines, and a dark flush flared high on his cheekbones. She had seen him look this way on the tennis courts behind the Bridgeton Academy building sometimes, when he blew an easy point. She had watched him play several times, including two sets during which he had mopped up her panting, puffing husband with ease. And on the few occasions she had seen him lose, his reaction had made her extremely uneasy about what she had gotten into with him. He had published poems in over 24 little magazines, and a book, Chasing Sundown, had been published by an outfit in Baton Rouge called The Press Over the Garage. He had graduated from Drew in New Jersey. He held strong opinions on modern art, the upcoming nuclear referendum question in Maine, the films of Andy Warhol, and he took a double fault the way Tad took the news it was bedtime. Now he came after her, grabbed her shoulder, and spun her around to face him. The carton of milk fell from her hand and split open on the floor. There, look at that, Donna said. Nice going, hot shot.
Listen, I'm not going to be pushed around. Do you? You get out of here! She screamed into his face. Her spittle sprayed his cheeks and his forehead. What do I have to do to convince you? Do you need a picture? You're not welcome here. Go be God's gift to some other woman.
You cheap, cock-teasing little bitch, he said.
His voice was sullen, his face ugly. He didn't let go of her arm.
And take the bureau with you. Pitch it in the dump.
She pulled free of him and got the wash rag from its place hung over the sink faucet. Her hands were trembling, her stomach was upset, and she was starting to get a headache. She thought that soon she would vomit. She got down on her hands and knees and began wiping up the spilled milk.
Yeah, you think you're something, he said. When did your crotch turn to gold? You loved it. You screamed for more.
You've got the right tense anyway, champ, she said, not looking up.
Her hair hung in her face, and she liked it that way just fine. She didn't want him to see how pale and sick her face was. She felt as if someone had pushed her into a nightmare. She felt that if she looked at herself in a mirror at this moment, she would see an ugly, capering witch.
Get out, Steve. I'm not going to tell you again.
And what if I don't? You're going to call Sheriff Bannerman? Sure. Just say, hi there, George. This is Mr. Businessman's wife, and the guy I've been screwing on the side won't leave. Would you please come on up here and roust him? That what you're going to say?
The fright went deep now. Before marrying Vic, she had been a librarian in the Westchester school system, and her own private nightmare had always been telling the kids for the third time, in her loudest speaking voice, to quiet down at once, please. When she did that, they always had, enough for her to get through the period at least. But what if they wouldn't? That was her nightmare. What if they absolutely wouldn't? What did that leave? The question scared her. It scared her that such a question should ever have to be asked, even to oneself, in the dark of night. She had been afraid to use her loudest voice, and had done so only when it became absolutely necessary, because that was where civilization came to an abrupt, screeching halt. That was the place where the tar turned to dirt. If they wouldn't listen when you used your very loudest voice, a scream became your only recourse. This was the same sort of fear. The only answer to the man's question, of course, was that she would scream if he came near her. But would she?
Go, she said in a lower voice. Please. It's over.
What if I decide it isn't? What if I decide to just rape you there on the floor in that damned spilled milk?
She looked up at him through the tangle of hair. Her face was still pale and her eyes were too big, ringed with white flesh.
Then you'll have a fight on your hands. And if I get a chance to tear your balls off or put one of your eyes out, I won't hesitate.
For just a moment before his face closed up, she thought he looked uncertain. He knew she was quick, in pretty good shape. He could beat her at tennis, but she made him sweat to do it. His balls and his eyes were probably safe, but she might very well put some furrows in his face. It was a question of how far he wanted to go. She smelled something thick and unpleasant in the air of her kitchen, some whiff of the jungle, and realized with dismay that it was a mixture of her fear and his rage. It was coming out of their pores.
I'll take the bureau back to my shop, he said.
Why don't you send your handsome hubby down for it, Donna? He and I can have a nice talk about stripping. He left then, pulling the door which communicated between the living room and the porch to behind him, almost hard enough to break the glass. A moment later, the engine of his van roared, settled into a ragged idle, and then dropped to a working pitch as he threw it in gear. He screeched his tires as he left. Donna finished wiping the milk up slowly, rising from time to time to wring out her rag in the stainless steel sink. She watched the threads of milk run down the drain. She was trembling all over, partly from reaction, partly from relief. She had barely heard Steve's implied threat to tell Vic. She could only think over and over again about the chain of events that had led to such an ugly scene. She sincerely believed she had drifted into her affair with Steve Kemp almost inadvertently. It was like an explosion of sewage from a buried pipe. A similar sewer pipe, she believed, ran beneath the neatly tended lawns of almost every marriage in America. She hadn't wanted to come to Maine, and had been appalled when Vic had sprung the idea on her. In spite of vacations there, and the vacations themselves might have reinforced the idea, she had thought of the state as a woodsy wasteland, a place where the snow drifted 20 feet high in the winters and people were virtually cut off. The thought of taking their baby into such an environment terrified her. She had pictured, to herself and aloud to Vic, sudden snowstorms blowing up, stranding him in Portland and her in Castle Rock. She thought and spoke of Tad swallowing pills in such a situation, or burning himself on the stove, or God knew what. And maybe part of her resistance had been a stubborn refusal to give up the excitement and hurry of New York. Well, face it, the worst hadn't been any of those things. The worst had been a nagging conviction that AdWorks would fail, and they would have to go crawling back with their tails between their legs. That hadn't happened, because Vic and Roger had worked their butts off. But that had also meant that she was left with a growing-up child and too much time on her hands. She could count her life's close friends on the fingers of one hand. She was confident that the ones she made would be her friends forever, come hell or high water. But she had never made friends quickly or easily. She had toyed with the idea of getting her Maine certification. Maine and New York were reciprocal. It was mostly a matter of filling out some forms. Then she could go see the superintendent of schools and get her name put on the sublist for Castle Rock High. It was a ridiculous notion, and she shelved it after running some figures on her pocket calculator. Gasoline and sitter's fees would eat up most of the $28 a day she might have made. "I've become the fabled great American housewife," she had thought dismally one day last winter, watching sleet spick and spack down against the porch storm windows. Sitting home, feeding Tad his Franks and beans or his toasted cheese sandwiches and Campbell's soup for lunch. Getting my slice of life from Lisa on As the World Turns and from Mike on The Young and the Restless. Every now and then we jive it up with a Wheel of Fortune session. She could go over and see Joni Welsh, who had a little girl about Tad's age, but Joni always made her uneasy. She was 3 years older than Donna and 10 pounds heavier. The extra 10 pounds did not seem to bother her. She said her husband liked her that way. Joni was contented with things as they were in Castle Rock. A little at a time, the shit had started to back up in the pipe. She started to sharpshoot at Vic about little things, sublimating the big things because they were hard to define and even harder to articulate. Things like loss and fear and getting older. Things like being lonely and then getting terrified of being lonely.
Things like hearing a song on the radio that you remembered from high school and bursting into tears for no reason. Feeling jealous of Vic because his life was a daily struggle to build something. He was a knight errant with a family crest embossed on his shield. And her life was back here, getting Tad through the day, jollying him when he was cranky, listening to his raps, fixing his meals and snacks. It was a life lived in the trenches. Too much of it was waiting and listening. And all along, she had thought that things would begin to smooth out when Tad was older. The discovery that it wasn't true brought on a kind of low-level horror. This past year, he had been out of the house 3 mornings a week at Jack and Jill Nursery School. This summer, it had been 5 afternoons a week at play camp. When he was gone, the house seemed shockingly empty. Doorways leaned and gaped with no Tad to fill them. The staircase yawned with no Tad halfway up, sitting there in his pajama bottoms before his nap, owlishly looking at one of his picture books. Doors were mouths, stairways throats. Empty rooms became traps. So she washed floors that didn't need to be washed. She watched the soaps. She thought about Steve Kemp, with whom she'd had a little flirtation since he had rolled into town the previous fall with Virginia license plates on his van and had set up a small stripping and refinishing business. She had caught herself sitting in front of the TV with no idea what was going on because she had been thinking about the way his deep tan contrasted with his tennis whites, or the way his ass pumped when he moved fast. And finally, she had done something. And today, she felt her stomach knot up, and she ran for the bathroom, her hands plastered to her mouth, her eyes wide and starry. She made it, barely, and tossed up everything. She looked at the mess she had made, and with a groan, she did it again. When her stomach felt better, but her legs were all a-tremble again, something lost, something gained, she looked at herself in the bathroom mirror. Her face was thrown into hard and unflattering relief by the fluorescent bar. Her skin was too white, her eyes red-rimmed. Her hair was plastered to her skull in an unflattering helmet. She saw what she was going to look like when she was old. And the most terrifying thing of all was that right now, if Steve Kemp was here, she thought she would let him make love to her if he would only hold her and kiss her and say that she didn't have to be afraid, that time was a myth and death was a dream, that everything was okay. A sound came out of her, a screaming sob that could surely not have been born in her chest. It was the sound of a madwoman. She lowered her head and cried. Charity Camber sat on the double bed she shared with her husband Joe and looked down at something she held in her hands. She had just come back from the store, the same one Donna Trenton patronized. Now her hands and feet and cheeks felt numb and cold, as if she had been out with Joe on the snowmobile for too long. But tomorrow was the 1st of July. The snowmobile was put neatly away in the back shed with its tarp snugged down. It can't be. There's been some mistake. But there was no mistake. She had checked half a dozen times, and there was no mistake. After all, it has to happen to somebody, doesn't it? Yes, of course. To somebody. But to her? She could hear Joe pounding on something in his garage, a high belling sound that beat its way into the hot afternoon like a hammer shaping thin metal. There was a pause, and then faintly, shit! The hammer struck once more, and there was a longer pause. Then her husband hollered, Brett! She always cringed a little when he raised his voice that way and yelled for their boy. Brett loved his father very much, but Charity had never been sure just how Joe felt about his son. That was a dreadful thing to be thinking, but it was true. Once, about 2 years ago, she had had a horrible nightmare, one she didn't think she would ever forget. She dreamed that her husband drove a pitchfork directly into Brett's chest. The tines went right through him and poked out the back of Brett's T-shirt, holding it out the way tent poles hold a tent up in the air.
"Little sucker didn't come when I hollered him down," her dream husband said.
And she had awakened with a jerk beside her real husband, who had been sleeping the sleep of beer beside her in his boxer shorts. The moonlight had been falling through the window and onto the bed where she now sat, moonlight in a cold and uncaring flood of light. And she had understood just how afraid a person could be, how fear was a monster with yellow teeth set afoot by an angry god to eat the unwary and the unfit. Joe had used his hands on her a few times in the course of their marriage, and she had learned. She wasn't a genius, maybe, but her mother hadn't raised any fools. Now she did what Joe told her and rarely argued. She guessed Brett was that way, too, but she feared for the boy sometimes. She went to the window in time to see Brett run across the yard and into the barn. Cujo trailed at Brett's heels, looking hot and dispirited. Faintly,
"Hold this for me, Brett."
More faintly,
"Sure, Daddy."
The hammering started again, that merciless ice-pick sound, whing, whing, whing. She imagined Brett holding something against something, a cold chisel against a frozen bearing, maybe, or a square spike against a lock bolt. Her husband, a pell-mell jittering in the corner of his thin mouth, his T-shirt sleeves rolled up, swinging a 5-pound pony hammer. And if he was drunk, if his aim was a little off. In her mind, she could hear Brett's agonized howl as the hammer mashed his hand to a red splintered pulp, and she crossed her arms over her bosom against the vision. She looked at the thing in her hand again and wondered if there was a way she could use it. More than anything in the world, she wanted to go to Connecticut to see her sister Holly. It had been 6 years now, in the summer of 1974. She remembered well enough because it had been a bad summer for her, except for that one pleasant weekend. 74 had been the year Brett's night problems had begun. Restlessness, bad dreams, and more frequently, incidents of sleepwalking. It was also the year Joe began drinking heavily. Brett's uneasy nights and his somnambulism had eventually gone away. Joe's drinking had not. Brett had been 4 then. He was 10 now, and didn't even remember his Aunt Holly, who had been married for 6 years. She had a little boy named after her husband and a little girl. Charity had never seen either child, her own niece and nephew, except for the Kodachromes Holly occasionally sent in the mail. She had gotten scared of asking Joe. He was tired of hearing her talk about it, and if she asked him again, he might hit her. It had been almost 16 months since she'd last asked him if maybe they couldn't take a little vacation down Connecticut way. Not much of a one for traveling was Mrs. Camber's son, Joe. He liked it just fine in Castle Rock. Once a year, he and that old tosspot Gary Pervier and some of their cronies would go up north to Moosehead to shoot deer. Last November, he had wanted to take Brett. She had put her foot down, and it had stayed down, in spite of Joe's sullen mutterings and Brett's wounded eyes. She was not going to have the boy out with that bunch of men for 2 weeks, listening to a lot of vulgar talk and jokes about sex and seeing what animals men could turn into when they got to drinking nonstop over a period of days and weeks. All of them with loaded guns walking in the woods. Loaded guns, loaded men. Somebody always got hurt sooner or later, fluorescent orange hats and vests or not. It wasn't going to be Brett, not her son.
The hammer struck the steel steadily, rhythmically. It stopped. She relaxed a little. Then it started again. She supposed that sooner or later Brett would go with them, and that would be the end of him for her. He would join their club, and ever after she would be little more than a kitchen drudge that kept the clubhouse neat. Yes, that day would come, and she knew it, and she grieved for it. But at least she had been able to stave it off for another year. And this year, would she be able to keep him home with her this November? Maybe not. Either way, it would be better, not all right, but at least better if she could take Brett down to Connecticut first, take him down there and show him how some... Oh, say it, if only to yourself. How some decent people lived. If Joe would let them go alone... But there was no sense thinking of that. Joe could go places alone or with his friends, but she couldn't, not even with Brett in tow. That was one of their marriage's ground rules. Yet she couldn't help thinking about how much better it would be without him. Without him sitting in Holly's kitchen swilling beer, looking Holly's gym up and down with those insolent brown eyes. It would be better without him being impatient to be gone until Holly and Jim were also impatient for them to be gone. She and Brett, just the two of them. They could go on the bus. She thought, last November, he wanted to take Brett hunting with him. She thought, could a trade be worked out? Cold came to her, filling the hollows of her bones with spun glass. Would she actually agree to such a trade? He could take Brett to Moosehead with him in the fall if Joe, in his turn, would agree to let them go to Stratford on the bus. There was money enough. Now there was. But money alone wouldn't do it. He'd take the money, and that would be the last she would see of it. Unless she played her cards just right. Just right. Her mind began to move faster. The pounding outside stopped. She saw Brett leave the barn trotting and was dimly grateful. Some premonitory part of her was convinced that if the boy ever came to serious harm, it would be in that dark place with the sawdust spread over the old grease on the plank floor. There was a way. There must be a way. If she was willing to gamble. In her fingers, she held a lottery ticket. She turned it over and over in her hand as she stood at the window, thinking. When Steve Kemp got back to his shop, he was in a kind of furious ecstasy. His shop was on the western outskirts of Castle Rock on Route 11. He had rented it from a farmer who had holdings in both Castle Rock and in neighboring Bridgeton. The farmer was not just a nerd, he was a super nerd. The shop was dominated by Steve's stripping vat, a corrugated iron pot that looked big enough to boil an entire congregation of missionaries at one time. Sitting around it like small satellites around a large planet was his work: bureaus, dressers, china cupboards, bookcases, tables. The air was aromatic with varnish, stripping compound, linseed oil. He had a fresh change of clothes in a battered TWA flight bag. He had planned to change after making love to the fancy cunt. Now he hurled the bag across the shop. It bounced off the far wall and landed on top of a dresser. He walked across to it and batted it aside.
He drop-kicked it as it came down, and it hit the ceiling before falling on its side like a dead woodchuck. Then he simply stood, breathing hard, inhaling the heavy smells, staring vacantly at three chairs he had promised to Kane by the end of the week. His thumbs were jammed into his belt. His fingers were curled into fists. His lower lip was pooched out. He looked like a kid sulking after a bawling out.
"Cheap shit," he breathed, and went after the flight bag.
He made as if to kick it again, then changed his mind and picked it up. He went through the shed and into the three-room house that adjoined the shop. If anything, it was hotter in the house. Crazy July heat. It got in your head. The kitchen was full of dirty dishes. Flies buzzed around a green plastic hefty bag filled with beefaroni and tuna fish cans. The living room was dominated by a big old Zenith black-and-white TV he had rescued from the Naples dump. A big spayed brindle cat, name of Bernie Carbo, slept on top of it like a dead thing. The bedroom was where he worked on his writing. The bed itself was a rollaway, not made, the sheets stiff with cum. No matter how much he was getting, and over the last 2 weeks that had been zero, he masturbated a great deal. Masturbation, he believed, was a sign of creativity. Across from the bed was his desk. A big old-fashioned Underwood sat on top of it. Manuscripts were stacked to both sides. More manuscripts, some in boxes, some secured with rubber bands, were piled up in one corner. He wrote a lot, and he moved around a lot, and his main luggage was his work. Mostly poems, a few stories, a surreal play in which the character spoke a grand total of 9 words, and a novel he had attacked badly from 6 different angles. It had been 5 years since he had lived in one place long enough to get completely unpacked. Last December, while shaving one day, he had discovered the first threads of gray in his beard. The discovery had thrown him into a savage depression, and he had stayed depressed for weeks. He hadn't touched a razor between then and now, as if it was the act of shaving that had somehow caused the gray to show up. He was 38. He refused to entertain the thought of being that old. But sometimes it crept up on his blind side and surprised him. To be that old, less than 700 days shy of 40, terrified him. He had really believed that 40 was for other people.
"That bitch," he thought over and over again, "that bitch."
He had left dozens of women since he had first gotten laid by a vague, pretty, softly helpless French substitute when he was a high school junior. But he himself had only been dropped 2 or 3 times. He was good at seeing the drop coming and opting out of the relationship first. It was a protective device, like bombing the Queen of Spades on someone else in a game of hearts. You had to do it while you could still cover the bitch, or you got screwed. You covered yourself. That way, you didn't think about your age. He had known Donna was cooling it, but she had struck him as a woman who could be manipulated with no great difficulty, at least for a while, by a combination of psychological and sexual factors. By fear, if you wanted to be crude. That it hadn't worked that way left him feeling hurt and furious, as if he had been whipped raw. He got out of his clothes, tossed his wallet and change onto his desk, went into the bathroom, showered. When he came out, he felt a little better. He dressed again, pulling jeans and a faded chambray shirt from the flight bag. He picked his change up, put it in a front pocket, and paused, looking speculatively at his Lord Buxton. Some of the business cards had fallen out. They were always doing that because there were so many of them. Steve Kemp had a pack rat sort of wallet. One of the items he almost always picked up and tucked away were business cards. They made nice bookmarks, and the space on the blank flip side was just right for jotting an address, simple directions, or a phone number. He would sometimes take two or three if he happened to be in a plumbing shop or if an insurance salesman stopped by. Steve would unfailingly ask the 9-to-5er for his card with a big, shit-eating grin. When he and Donna were going at it hot and heavy, he had happened to notice one of her husband's business cards lying on top of the TV. Donna had been taking a shower or something. He had taken the business card. No big reason, just the pack rat thing. Now he opened his wallet and thumbed through the cards, cards from prudential agents in Virginia, realtors in Colorado, a dozen businesses in between. For a moment, he thought he had lost Handsome Hubby's card, but it had just slipped down between a couple of dollar bills. He fished it out and looked at it. White card, blue lettering done in modish lower case. Mr. Businessman Triumphant. Quiet, but impressive. Nothing flashy. Roger Breakstone, AdWorks, Victor Trenton. 1633 Congress Street, Telex AdWorks, Portland, Maine, 04001, telephone 207-799-8600. Steve pulled a sheet of paper from a ream of cheap mimeo stuff and cleared a place in front of him. He looked briefly at his typewriter. No, each machine's typescript was as individual as a fingerprint. It was his crooked lowercase a that hung the blighter, Inspector. The jury was only out long enough to have tea. This would not be a police matter, no how, no way, but caution came without even thinking. Cheap paper available at any office supply store, no typewriter. He took a Pilot razor point from the coffee can on the corner of the desk and printed in large block letters, "Hello, Vic. Nice wife you've got there. I enjoyed fucking the shit out of her." He paused, tapping the pen against his teeth. He was starting to feel good again. On top. Of course, she was a good-looking woman, and he supposed there was always the possibility that Trenton might discount what he had written so far. Talk was cheap, and you could mail someone a letter for less than the price of a coffee. But there was something, always something. What might it be? He smiled suddenly. When he smiled that way, his entire face lit up, and it was easy to see why he had never had much trouble with women since the evening with the vague, pretty French sub. He wrote, "What's that mole just above her pubic hair look like to you? To me, it looks like a question mark. Do you have any questions?" That was enough. A meal is as good as a feast, his mother had always said. He found an envelope and put the message inside. After a pause, he slipped the business card in and addressed the envelope, also in block letters, to Vic's office. After a moment's thought, he decided to show the poor slob a little mercy and added "personal" below the address. He propped the letter on the windowsill and leaned back in his chair, feeling totally good again. He would be able to write tonight. He felt sure of it. Outside, a truck with out-of-state plates pulled into his driveway, a pickup with a great big Hoosier cabinet in the back. Someone had picked up a bargain at a barn sale. Lucky them. Steve strolled out. He would be glad to take their money and their Hoosier cabinet, but he really doubted if he would have time to do the work. Once that letter was mailed, a change of air might be in order. But not too big a change, at least not for a while. He felt he owed it to himself to stay in the area long enough to make at least one more visit to little Miss High Pockets.
When it could be ascertained that handsome hubby was definitely not around, of course. Steve had played tennis with the guy, and he was no ball of fire. Thin, heavy glasses, spaghetti backhand. But you never knew when a handsome hubby was going to go off his gourd and do something antisocial. A good many handsome hubbies kept guns around the house, so he would want to check out the scene carefully before popping in. He would allow himself the one single visit, and then close this show entirely. He would maybe go to Ohio for a while, or Pennsylvania, or Taos, New Mexico. But like a practical joker who had stuffed a load into someone's cigarette, he wanted to stick around at a prudent distance, of course, and watch it blow up. The driver of the pickup and his wife were peering into the shop to see if he was there. Steve strolled out, hands in the pockets of his jeans, smiling. The woman smiled back immediately. "Hi, folks. Can I help you?" he asked, and thought that he would mail the letter as soon as he could get rid of them. That evening, as the sun went down red and round and hot in the west, Vic Trenton, his shirt tied around his waist by the arms, was looking into the engine compartment of his wife's Pinto. Donna was standing beside him, looking young and fresh in a pair of white shorts and a red-checked sleeveless blouse. Her feet were bare. Tad, dressed only in his bathing suit, was driving his trike madly up and down the driveway, playing some sort of mind game that apparently had Ponch and John from Chips pitted against Darth Vader. "Drink your iced tea before it melts," Donna told Vic.
"Uh-huh."
The glass was on the side of the engine compartment. Vic had a couple of swallows, put it back without looking, and it tumbled off into his wife's hand.
"Hey," he said. "Nice catch."
She smiled. "I just know you when your mind's somewhere else, that's all. Look, didn't spill a drop." They smiled into each other's eyes for a moment. A good moment, Vic thought. Maybe it was just his imagination or wishful thinking, but lately it seemed there were more of the good small moments. Less of the sharp words, fewer silences which were cold, or maybe this was worse, just indifferent. He didn't know what the cause was, but he was grateful.
"Strictly AAA Farm Club," he said. "You got a ways to go before you make the bigs, kid."
"So, what's wrong with my car, coach?" He had the air cleaner off. It was sitting in the driveway. "Never saw a Frisbee like that before," Tad had said matter-of-factly a few moments ago, swerving his trike around it. Vic leaned back in and poked aimlessly at the carburetor with the head of his screwdriver. "It's in the carb. I think the needle valve's sticking."
"That's bad?"
"Not too bad," he said. "But it can stop you cold if it decides to stick shut. The needle valve controls the flow of gas into the carb, and without gas, you don't go. It's like a national law, babe."
"Daddy, will you push me on the swing?"
"Yeah, in a minute."
"Good. I'll be in the back."
Tad started around the house toward the swing and gym set Vic had built last summer, while lubricating himself well with gin and tonics, working from a set of plans. Doing it after supper on weeknights and on weekends with the voices of the Boston Red Sox announcers blaring from the transistor radio beside him. Tad, them three, sat solemnly on the cellar bulkhead or on the back steps, chin cupped in his hands, fetching things sometimes, mostly watching silently. Last summer. A good summer, not as beastly hot as this one. It had seemed then that Donna had finally adjusted and was seeing that Maine, Castle Rock, Adworks, those things could be good for all of them. Then the mystifying bad patch, the worst of it being that nagging, almost psychic feeling that
things were even more wrong than he wanted to think about. Things in the house began to seem subtly out of place, as if unfamiliar hands had been moving them around. He had gotten the crazy idea, was it crazy, that Donna was changing the sheets too often. They were always clean, and one night that old fairy tale question had popped into his mind, echoing unpleasantly, "Who's been sleeping in my bed?" Now things had loosened up, it seemed. If not for the crazy raspberry zingers business and the rotten trip hanging over his head, he would feel that this could be a pretty good summer, too. It might even turn out that way. You won sometimes. Not all hopes were vain. He believed that, although his belief had never been seriously tested. "Tad," Donna yelled, bringing the boy to a screeching halt, "put your trike in the garage."
"Mommy."
"Now, please, monsieur." "Monsieur," Tad said and laughed into his hands.
"You didn't put your car away, Mom."
"Daddy is working on my car."
"Yeah, but..."
"Mind your mom, Tadder," Vic said, picking up the air cleaner. "I'll be around shortly." Tad mounted his trike and drove into the garage, accompanying himself with a loud, ululating ambulance wail.
"Why are you putting it back on?" Donna asked. "Aren't you going to fix it?"
"It's a precision job," Vic said. "I don't have the tools. Even if I did, I'd probably make it worse instead of better."
"Damn," she said morosely and kicked a tire. "These things never happen until the warranty runs out, do they?"
The Pinto had just over 20,000 miles on it and was still 6 months from being theirs free and clear.
"That's like a national law, too," Vic said.
He put the air cleaner back on its post and tightened the butterfly nut.
"I guess I can run over to South Paris while Tad's in his day camp. I'll have to get a loaner, though, with you being gone. Will it get me to South Paris, Vic?"
"Sure. But you don't have to do that. Take it out to Joe Camber's place. That's only 7 miles, and he does good work. Remember when that wheel bearing went on the jag? He took it out with a chain fall made out of old lengths of telephone pole and charged $10. Man, if I'd gone to that place in Portland, they would have mounted my checkbook like a moose head."
"That guy made me nervous," Donna said. "Aside from the fact that he was about 2.5 sheets to the wind, I mean."
"How did he make you nervous?"
"Busy eyes."
Vic laughed. "Honey, with you, there's a lot to be busy about."
"Thank you," she said.
"A woman doesn't necessarily mind being looked at. It's being mentally undressed that makes you nervous."
She paused, strangely, he thought, looking away at the grim red light in the west. Then she looked back at him.
"Some men give you the feeling that there's a little movie called The Rape of the Sabine Women going on in their heads all the time. And you just got the starring role."
He had that curious, unpleasant feeling that she was talking about several things at once, again. But he didn't want to get into that tonight, not when he was finally crawling out from under a shit heap of a month. Babe, he's probably completely harmless. He's got a wife, a kid.
Yes, probably he is. But she crossed her arms over her breasts and cupped her elbows in her palms, a characteristic gesture of nervousness with her.
"Look," he said, "I'll run your Pinto up there this Saturday and leave it if I have to, okay? More likely he'll be able to get right to it. I'll have a couple of beers with him and pat his dog. You remember that St. Bernard?" Donna grinned.
"I even remember his name.
He practically knocked Tad over, licking him.
You remember?
Vic nodded. The rest of the afternoon, Tad goes around after him saying, "Cujo! Here, Cujo!" They laughed together.
"I feel so damn stupid sometimes," Donna said. "If I could use a standard shift, I could just run the jag while you're gone."
"You're just as well off. The jag's eccentric. You gotta talk to it." He slammed the hood of the Pinto back down.
"Ooh, you dummy," she moaned. "Your iced tea glass was in there."
And he looked so comically surprised that she went off into gales of laughter. After a minute, he joined her. Finally, it got so bad that they had to hang on to each other like a couple of drunks. Tad came back around the house to see what was going on, his eyes round. At last, convinced that they were mostly all right in spite of the nutty way they were acting, he joined them. This was about the same time that Steve Kemp mailed his letter, less than 2 miles away. Later, as dusk settled down and the heat slacked off a little and the first fireflies started to stitch seams in the air across the backyard, Vic pushed his son on the swing.
"Higher, Daddy, higher!"
"If you go any higher, you're gonna loop the loop, kid."
"Get me under then, Dad. Get me under."
Vic gave Tad a huge push, propelling the swing toward the sky where the first stars were just beginning to appear, and ran all the way under the swing. Tad screamed joyfully, his head tilted back, his hair blowing.
"That was good, Daddy. Get me under again."
Vic gave his son under again, from the front this time, and Tad went soaring into the still, hot night. Aunt Evie Chalmers lived close by, and Tad's shouts of terrified glee were the last sounds she heard as she died. Her heart gave out, one of its paper-thin walls breaching suddenly and almost painlessly, as she sat in her kitchen chair, a cup of coffee by one hand, and a straight 8 Herbert Tarryton by the other. She leaned back, and her vision darkened, and somewhere she heard a child crying. And for a moment, it seemed that the cries were joyful. But as she went out, suddenly propelled as if by a hard but not unkind push from behind, it seemed to her that the child was screaming in fear, in agony. Then she was gone, and her niece Abby would find her the following day, her coffee as cold as she was, her cigarette a perfect and delicate tube of ash, her lower plate protruding from her wrinkled mouth like a slot filled with teeth. Just before Tad's bedtime, he and Vic sat on the back stoop. Vic had a beer, Tad had milk.
"Daddy?"
"What?"
"I wish you didn't have to go away next week."
"I'll be back."
"Yeah, but..."
Tad was looking down, struggling with tears. Vic put a hand on his neck.
"But what, big guy?"
"Who's gonna say the words that keep the monster out of the closet? Mommy doesn't know them. Only you know them."
Now the tears spilled over and ran down Tad's face.
"Is that all?" Vic asked.
The monster words, Vic had originally dubbed them the Monster Catechism, but Tad had trouble with that word, so it had been shortened, had come about in late spring, when Tad began to be afflicted with bad dreams and night fears. There was something in his closet, he said. Sometimes at night his closet door would swing open and he would see it in there, something with yellow eyes that wanted to eat him up. Donna had thought it might have been some fallout from Maurice Sendak's book Where the Wild Things Are. Vic had wondered aloud to Roger, but not to Donna, if maybe Tad had picked up a garbled account of the mass murders that had taken place in Castle Rock and had decided that the murderer, who had become a kind of town boogeyman, was alive and well in his closet. Roger said he supposed it was possible,
With kids, anything was possible.
And Donna herself had begun to get a little spooked after a couple of weeks of this. She told Vic one morning in a kind of laughing, nervous way that things in Tad's closet sometimes appeared moved around.
"Well, Tad did it," Vic had responded.
"You don't understand," Donna said. "He doesn't go back there anymore, Vic. Never. He's scared to." And she had added that sometimes it seemed to her that the closet actually smelled bad after Tad's bouts of nightmare followed by waking fear. Like an animal had been caged up in there. Disturbed, Vic had gone into the closet and sniffed. In his mind was a half-formed idea that perhaps Tad was sleepwalking, perhaps going into his closet and urinating in there as a part of some odd dream cycle. He had smelled nothing but mothballs. The closet, finished wall on one side and bare lathing on the other, stretched back some 8 feet. It was as narrow as a Pullman car. There was no boogeyman back in there, and Vic most certainly did not come out in Narnia. He got a few cobwebs in his hair. That was all. Donna had suggested first what she called good dream thoughts to combat Tad's night fears. Then prayer. Tad responded to the former by saying that the thing in his closet stole his good dream thoughts. He responded to the latter by saying that since God didn't believe in monsters, prayers were useless. Her temper had snapped, perhaps partly because she had been spooked by Tad's closet herself. Once, while hanging some of Tad's shirts in there, the door had swung quietly shut behind her, and she'd had a bad 40 seconds fumbling her way back to the door and getting out. She had smelled something in there that time. Something hot and close and violent. A matted smell. It reminded her a little of Steve Kemp's sweat after they finished making love. The upshot was her curt suggestion that, since there were no such things as monsters, Tad should put the whole thing out of his mind, hug his teddy, and go to sleep. Vic either saw more deeply or remembered more clearly about the closet door that turned into an unhinged idiot mouth in the dark of night, a place where strange things sometimes rustled, a place where hanging clothes sometimes turned into hanging men. He remembered vaguely about the shadows the streetlight could throw on the wall in the endless 4 hours that followed the turn of the day, and the creaking sounds that might have been the house settling, or that might, just might, be something creeping up. His solution had been the monster catechism, or just the monster words if you were 4 and not much into semantics. Either way, it was nothing more nor less than a primitive incantation to keep evil at bay. Vic had invented it one day on his lunch hour, and to Donna's mixed relief and chagrin, it worked when her own efforts to use psychology, parent effectiveness training, and finally blunt discipline had failed. Vic spoke it over Tad's bed every night like a benediction as Tad lay there naked under a single sheet in the sweltering dark. "Do you think that's going to do him any good in the long run?" Donna asked. Her voice held both amusement and irritation. This had been in mid-May, when the tensions between them had been running high.
"Ad men don't care about the long run," Vic had answered. "They care about fast, fast, fast relief. And I'm good at my job."
"Yeah. Nobody to say the monster words. That's the matter. That's a lot the matter,"
Tad answered now, wiping the tears off his cheeks in disgust and embarrassment.
"Well, listen," Vic said. "They're written down. That's how I can say them the same every night. I'll print them on a piece of paper and tack them to your wall, and Mommy can read them to you every night I'm gone."
"Yeah? Will you?"
"Sure," Said I would.
You won't forget.
No way, man. I'll do it tonight. Tad put his arms around his father, and Vic hugged him tight. That night, after Tad slept, Vic went quietly into the boy's room and tacked a sheet of paper to the wall with a pushpin. He put it right next to Tad's Mighty Marvel calendar, where the kid couldn't miss it. Printed in large, clear letters on this sheet of paper was "The Monster Words, for Tad." "Monsters, stay out of this room. You have no business here. No monsters under Tad's bed. You can't fit under there. No monsters hiding in Tad's closet. It's too small in there. No monsters outside of Tad's window. You can't hold on out there. No vampires, no werewolves, no things that bite. You have no business here. Nothing will touch Tad or hurt Tad all this night. You have no business here." Vic looked at this for a long time and reminded himself to tell Donna at least twice more before he left to read it to the kid every night, to impress on her how important the monster words were to Tad. On his way out, he saw the closet door was open, just a crack. He closed the door firmly and left his son's room. Sometime much later that evening, the door swung open again. Heat lightning flickered sporadically, tattooing crazy shadows in there. But Tad did not wake. The next day, at 7:15 in the morning, Steve Kemp's van backed out onto Route 11. Steve made miles, heading for Route 302. There he would turn left and drive southeast, crossing the state to Portland. He intended to flop at the Portland YMCA for a while. On the van's dashboard was a neat pile of addressed mail, not printed in block letters this time, but typed on his own machine. The typewriter was now in the back of the van, along with the rest of his stuff. It had taken him only an hour and a half to pack in his Castle Rock operation, including Bernie Carbo, who was now snoozing in his box by the rear doors. He and Bernie traveled light. The typing job on the envelopes was a professional one. 16 years of creative writing had turned him into an excellent typist, if nothing else. He pulled over to the same box from which he had posted the anonymous note to Vic Trenton the night before and dropped the letters in. It would not have bothered him in the least to run out owing rent on the shop and the house if he had intended to leave the state. But since he was only going as far as Portland, it seemed prudent to do everything legally. This time he could afford not to cut corners. There was better than $600 in cash tucked into the small bolt hole behind the van's glove compartment. In addition to a check covering the rent he owed, he was returning deposits to several people who had made them on bigger jobs. Accompanying each check was a polite note saying he was very sorry to have caused any inconvenience, but his mother had been taken suddenly and seriously ill. Every red-blooded American was a sucker for a mom story. Those for whom he had contracted to do work could pick up their furniture at the shop. The key was on the ledge above the door, just to the right, and would they kindly return the key to the same place after they made their pickup? Thank you, blah-de-blah, bullshit, bullshit. There would be some inconvenience, but no real hassle. Steve dropped the letters into the mailbox. There was that satisfied feeling of having his ass well covered. He drove away toward Portland, singing along with the Grateful Dead, who were delivering sugaree. He pushed the van up to 55, hoping traffic would stay light, so he could get to Portland early enough to grab a court at Tennis of Maine. All in all, it looked like a good day. If Mr. Businessman hadn't received his little letter bomb yet, he surely would today. Nifty, Steve thought, and burst out laughing.